Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny. NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen says that the media is falling short in its campaign coverage and reporting on President Trump. Some of the problems are not new, things like an emphasis on horse race reporting and both sidesism. Now, he says, the media is failing to adequately respond to an administration that appears to be taking steps toward autocracy. Rosen recently recommended that newsrooms direct their coverage toward very real threats to democracy, like Trump's claims that mail-in ballots will lead to a rigged election. Coming up on Forum, we'll hear from Jay Rosen about how the press has covered President Trump and what changes are needed for the 2020 election. That's next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Donald Trump is on Twitter again today, making reckless claims about mail-in voting and raising doubts about the integrity of the 2020 election. It is comments like that which led media critic Jay Rosen to write last month that the president now posed an active threat to American democracy. But the press, Rosen says, is still failing to cover and convey the urgency of that threat. Instead, reporters too often amplify the president's dubious claims and normalize his conduct. Jay Rosen, teaches journalism at New York University and writes the blog PressThink.org, and he joins us now to lay out the shortcomings of traditional campaign coverage in the Trump era and how the news outlet should respond. And welcome, Jay Rosen. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, I guess I'd like to begin by sort of getting you to amplify on your thoughts here, because if I can plain and bluntly put it, you're talking about the fourth estate failing us because there's a serious threat to our democracy, and that serious threat is really President Trump.
Yeah, we have an election. Journalists are used to covering elections by assuming that there's a common set of procedures that both sides agree to, and that there's a common world of fact that everyone in the system acknowledges. And they have built their routines for reporting on campaigns on those assumptions. But for years now, and especially as we get closer to the election, President Trump violates all of those assumptions. To take a simple example, he's trying to lower confidence in the results of the election before we even have it, which is pretty much unprecedented. And so what I'm complaining about or criticizing in the press is a failure to adapt to a candidate and a person in power who is trying to undermine the system by which we have free and fair elections. And that's why I call him a threat. He's a threat not because his tweets are nasty and full of untruths. He's a threat because he can use the power of the presidency and of the government to undo our free and fair elections. And that is a huge reality out there right now that has to be reflected in press coverage.
Well, you're saying also essentially that he's using the presidency to undermine the integrity of the elections. But when that gets into journalists and the media, one has to ask, how are they supposed to respond and in what ways are they supposed to respond, particularly really to, let me put it to you bluntly again. I mean, often they respond to facts and facts seem to fall on deaf ears, particularly where the president is concerned.
Well, let's separate two things. There's the question of how they should report a contest like this. And that's, to me, is a different question from how do you persuade the president's supporters that there's something dangerous afoot? So taking the first question, I think the most important step for journalists is to figure out what their agenda is in covering this campaign. And I'm using the word agenda, which I know is provocative on purpose, to draw attention to the fact that unless you know what you're trying to defend, you will get swept up in the Trump hurricane because he creates so much controversy. He creates so much news by the traditional definition of news. He says so many outrageous things. He does so many outrageous things, and he's threatening the election on so many different levels that if you just go into this with the determination to cover the news or cover the campaign, you're going to be lost. And so I've tried to argue that journalists trying to cover 2020 have to first decide, what are we trying to defend here? What are we trying to protect? And then decide accordingly on their coverage. So for example, the Guardian US edition has from the beginning made a huge priority of its coverage, the election system itself, and things like mail-in voting and difficulties in counting votes and security of elections and the kinds of attacks on the vote itself that we might see. And that's been a huge priority of theirs. But I think every news organization has to decide what it's going to defend against this president. And I know that newsrooms are reluctant to do that because they don't want to be seen as partisan and they don't want to tip the election in one way or another. But I'm not talking about which candidate journalists support. That's not relevant to their work. Instead, they've got to ground their campaign coverage in something more solid than just trying to report the news.
Well, recently, for example, I was mentioning facts. I remember Kellyanne Conway talking about alternate facts, but George Stephanopoulos actually challenged the president when he said that he had a health plan and that it would take care of pre-existing conditions. And Stephanopoulos, right, you know, stepped up to the fact that that's just not a fact. And this is certainly what one would expect of journalists. And what certainly you write about, the necessity, in other words, to convey truth and to get moral clarity. Paula Reed recently challenged the president when he said he signed the Veterans Choice Act, which he didn't. President Obama
did.
But again, you get back to the sensibility of all of this in terms of what you're talking about. That is, journalists feeling they have to play fair and they have to present both sides and they can't seem partisan. And so they don't go after the president as much as they should on many of these facts, and on facts, just facts alone. And as I said, often those facts don't seem to resonate, particularly don't resonate to his base.
Well, it goes even beyond that. Glenn Kessler, who's the fact checker for the Washington Post, and came out with a book earlier this year about all of the lies and distortions that come from President Trump and the White House, has said that prior to President Trump, candidates and presidents of both parties would react in a similar way if something they said was fact-checked and found to be false. That is, they would stop saying it, or they would change the claim so that it kind of met the definition of factual, or they would take it out of some speech, or they would do something to remove the penalty of being called an unreliable source of information. And Republican candidates and presidents did this. Democratic candidates and presidents did this. That's how they behaved. And the whole practice of fact-checking was kind of built on the assumption that you could shame the recalcitrant politician into better behavior. And it kind of sort of worked. Now, with Trump, not only does he not fix it, but he frequently doubles down on it, or if it's been fact-checked, makes it part of his stump speech because he doesn't care, because he probably doesn't even know what truth is compared to making something up, but also because when he is criticized by the media for saying things that are untrue, he kind of uses that conflict to generate support from his core supporters. So the position of being denounced as unfactual, of being called a liar, is actually something he converts into an advantage because now he is portrayed as being as warring with the news media, the fake news. And this system is so different than what journalists are used to participating in that they just sort of can't imagine that their routines could collapse like that their entire way of operating could be threatened by somebody like Trump. But in fact, It is. I'm sorry for the long-winded explanation, but that is the reality that they face.
And again, we're talking about how the media should cover President Trump in the 2020 election with Jay Rosen. He teaches journalism at New York University, writes the blog PressThink.org. Is Todd Gitlin still with you at NYU, by the way?
He is at Columbia, but he's a friend of mine. I know him well.
Friend of ours as well. And just wanted to mention his name and remember him here. It's been a while since we've been in contact with him. But I want to go back to really talking about what you're talking about, which is the decorousness maybe of the press, or trying to follow protocols, trying to follow a kind of tradition that may not be in this era even apt or appropriate. And a lot of that, let me actually read something and get your response to it. It's from Jim Fallows, another journalist that you probably know well.
Yep.
Who for many years was editor-in-chief of the Atlantic Monthly, and even before that, editor of U.S. News and World Report. He says the press has actually refused or been unable to recognize what it was dealing with. I mean, this goes to the heart of, I think, what you were saying. And let me just read what Jim Fallows says. They were dealing with a person markedly using racial resentment as a tool, where dishonesty and corruption essentially were downplayed and were far more ruinous than putting the Clintons together or even former presidents, whose knowledge was about as vast as about the organization he was set to control to any page on Capitol Hill, and most immigrants who would pass the U.S. citizenship test. Now, that sounds like a pretty harsh indictment, but it also sounds certainly to many to be apt and appropriate.
Yeah, and what Fallows is saying there is that he's both utterly unqualified and engaging in behavior that we simply don't associate with the president. An example of that is we're used to presidents who, when they win election, then try in governing to expand the coalition that elected them. And the press and the political class kind of invented this tool for measuring whether the president has succeeded at that. It's called the approval rating. So when your approval rating is higher than the portion that voted for you, you are kind of winning as the president, because you're persuading people who weren't your supporters that you are their president too. And that's how we kind of judge presidents, and that's what we expected from them for the entire period from Eisenhower to today.
Forgive me, and, Jay, to unify rather than to divide.
Yes, and to try and persuade people who didn't support you to come to your side. And Trump has a completely different idea, which is to polarize the electorate as much as possible and hope that the half that he gets is bigger than the other half.
All right, we're coming up on a break, but when we come back, I want to ask you also about how you guard against this and perhaps not make the same mistakes that were made in 2016. We're talking again with Jay Rosen. If you'd like to join us, please do so. How do you think the media has covered President Trump, and what do you think they should do differently for this election? You can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Jay Rosen. He is professor of journalism at New York University, writes the blog PressThink.org, and we're talking about how the media should cover President Trump and the 2020 election. And I want to go right to that and to your calls and emails. But first, what about, Jay, what about coverage of White House press briefings? They've been a particular challenge with this White House. And in fact, the president has snapped at many reporters and sort of set himself off in that division that you were talking about before. This is, after all, the fake media, and therefore they should be treated with hostility. Should the press corps just have boycotted?
In my view, Trump's press briefings and Kayleigh McEnany's, the current press secretary's briefings, have no purpose in public information that we could identify. And they are primarily stages set so that Trump or his officials can fight with the press. And what I think they should do is let the briefing room be taken over by Fox and OANN and other pro-Trump media, watch the proceedings on television. If something newsworthy or important is said, you would, of course, report that. But I don't think there's any reason for the press to be there anymore. And in the case of the virus briefings, where he's talking about a public health emergency, it's actually dangerous to carry that live because there's so much misinformation in it, and it's life and death.
Well, even when he's not giving a press briefing, there are life and death situations. I mean, in fact, I'd like to get your take on what recently occurred. The head of the CDC, Robert Redfield, said we're not going to get a vaccine likely until late in January at the earliest. And, in fact, Scott Atlas, White House health advisor, said the same thing. And President Trump's, you know, politicizing it. And you make a good distinction between politicizing as opposed to being political. But President Trump came out and said, I think it's likely we're going to have something. It was misspeaking by the head of the CDC, and we'll have something before the election. So what's the role for journalists when you have a simple distortion of that kind and a lie, really, and a delusion? I don't know what even to call it, mendacity.
The way I've tried to put it, Michael, is this. It's really difficult to get your mind around the fact that the single most potent force for misinforming the American public is the President of the United States. But it's really important to get your mind around that fact, because changes in press behavior have to follow from that. If you just allow him to talk to the country, you are participating in misinforming the country. That is the reality. And I still think, after all this time, that the Washington press corps hasn't quite adjusted for that.
But you also make another distinction that I think is important between earned media and paid media. And the paid media is operating on a number of clicks they can get. We had Brian Stelter on recently, the author of Hoax and a CNN talking head. And he was talking about the fact that, you know, Trump got $2 billion worth of free airtime coverage because Trump brings up ratings. And, you know, I've read your stuff, and you make a good argument for what we try to do at NPR and KQED in terms of having a commonwealth and having, you know, a public information type of journalism that doesn't necessarily operate on the basis of what corporations are paying for ads and all the rest of that. But this president has to be held accountable, and the sense of being able to hold this president accountable goes almost counter to what the media is trying to do, which is to create ratings.
Yeah, the rating system is definitely in the way, because Trump remains, even at this late date, a kind of an exciting danger. He creates controversy. He creates fights. You know, fights are easy to watch. But what I would like to see is the notion of earned media, which is what the political class calls news. Earned media should really be earned. And so if he's addressing common facts that are actually facts, then yes, he's earned coverage. If he's responding to something Joe Biden actually said, as opposed to just making it up, that is earned coverage. If he somehow can manage to sort of be a reality-based candidate, then that should be earned coverage. But just because he's the president and he says these wild and crazy things that are invented, and he's living in some sort of alternative reality, that is not earned media. That's a kind of propaganda that the press is assisting in.
Well, you talk about the press really talking about, for example, the human race as opposed to the horse race, but more people perhaps want to tune into a horse race. And what are we going to be doing in, or what should we be doing in 2020 that was not done in 2016? Or how do we turn things away from the horse race and more to the human race, or more to asking questions that really have to do with what listeners and viewers really need to know, the real issues, if you will?
Well, for a long time, there's been an alternative model for election coverage out there. It actually emerged in the early 90s and was proven to work at the local level. It's called the citizens agenda style of election coverage, which begins in a completely different place. The current model, the dominant model, which is horse race coverage, asks who's going to win and how are they likely to win it. And it treats the election as a race where the most important story is who's going to come out on top. And the Citizens Agenda style, you begin in a different place. You start by asking the people you're trying to inform, what do you want the candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? What do you want the candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Which is not exactly the same thing as what are your top issues, because the issues often come prefabricated by the political system themselves. So if you can ask enough people that question, what do you want the candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes, and you put all their answers together, you get a kind of priority list or agenda coming from the voters. And then you can use that agenda as your guide for campaign coverage, and you can perform a very important role, which is get the candidates to address the citizens' agenda. And this approach, as I said, has been out there for a long time. It's an alternative way of doing it. The press could have developed this starting in the early 90s, but instead it's gone with this other model that we all know so well. And so I've tried to get at least local news organizations to try the citizens agenda approach, and slowly and surely it's starting to emerge in different places around the country, but not from the big national players.
Yeah, you talk about the need for a new subsidy system, and I think some of the models here are the BBC and the ARD in Germany and the NRK in Norway. But let me bring a caller aboard. And by the way, if you'd like to join us in this conversation with Jay Rosen, you can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. The number again for your calls, 866-733-6786. How do you think the media has covered President Trump, and what do you think they should do differently for this election? You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Let me bring Marshall on. Marshall, join us. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And Jay, I'm curious as to your thoughts on the entire kind of alternative reality industrial complex that's been set up in with the right-wing funded Fox News to begin with, and then the, you know, the corresponding online and digital media that support that as well. I feel like that's a factor against the rest of the media being honest and calling out Trump and Republicans in general, because just remember, you also have high-ranking Republicans, you know, acting like this as well. And to again, Glenn Kessler's point, there used to be a penalty for this type of behavior, but I feel like Fox News and this right-wing ecosystem have now removed that penalty. And I'm wondering how journalists cope with that when there's literally no disincentive for these people to not lie, to not create this reality in which they can just thrive and misinformation thrives as well. So thank you very much for addressing this. And
thank you for the good, thoughtful question, Marshall. Jay Rosen.
Well, Marshall said two important points there, and let's take them in turn. The first is, it's true that the existence of the right-wing media sphere, which runs on a different reality than the rest of the news media, is crucial to the patterns that have emerged under Trump. One way to say it is that about a third, between 25 and 33%, somewhere in there, let's say 30% of the public, has now in a way been broken off and isolated in an information sphere of its own, where Trump is the major source of information about Trump. And that, when you think about it, is an authoritarian news system up and running in the country that used to have the freest press in the world. Because that group of people not only doesn't use the rest of the media as consumers of it, it is actively hostile to the portrait of the world that the rest of the news media puts out day by day. And that's a huge factor in how we've gotten to where we are today. The other huge factor, maybe even bigger, is that the GOP's leadership has not pushed back against this. Political scientists will tell you that the supporters of the president don't usually respond to arguments from the other side, but when important figures in their own party criticize the president or push back on what he says, that does matter to his supporters. And this is what we have not seen from the Republican Party. The people who have the ability to do that in the Senate, in the rest of the party, simply won't oppose Donald Trump. And that's a huge factor in our politics today. We've now become used to it, but the Trump phenomena as it stands in election 2020 could not have happened without this desertion by Republican leadership.
Which brings up another factor that I'm going to mention, and that's something you write about. It's a real phenomenon. It's something that Steve Bannon initially brought to attention, that's jamming the system with junk stories. And it prompts me to ask you about the press getting a lot of heat for being reactive in Trump's latest wild claim or action, latest tweet that comes out, but also ignoring the things he does. Where's the line between being responding to what you're calling a threat and being reactive?
Yeah. One way to look at this is you could say that Trump and Bannon and his philosophy of flooding the zone with too much news has hacked the newsworthiness system. Like, newsworthiness was a set of factors that could cause press coverage to happen. And Trump says so many newsworthy things that if you're just using these old newsworthy factors, which, for example, emphasize conflict, outrageousness, anything unusual, anything offensive. He produces like unlimited amounts of news just by his daily behavior. Somehow the press system has to rethink newsworthiness itself and begin to separate things that Trump is doing that kind of don't have a reality of their own. They're simply controversy creating, or they're said in order to control attention or to blot out the sky, versus things that he's doing that actually change the world. And so separating what he's saying from what he's doing has to be like job number one, because if you go simply by newsworthiness, everything he's doing is newsworthy because it's so wretched and so amazing and so incredible and so different than what we expect.
But you have to do better at curating the news too, I think. It's almost axiomatic to say. I was thinking about the 2016 election, the most recognized words, and this again goes back to the article I alluded to by Jim Fallows in the coverage, when it came to Trump, were speech, immigration, and Mexico. For Hillary Rodham Clinton, the one word above all was emails. I mean, that was the press trying to present both sides. And there's also the example of when Clinton, Secretary Clinton, was Senator Clinton was Secretary of State, Benghazi was in the news for years. There were 10 congressional hearings about Benghazi. Now we have the news that Russians are paying bounties on U.S. troops. It was in the news for about 3 months and barely covered now at all. I mean, it's kind of disappeared, in fact.
Yeah, can I say something about that?
Please.
One of the problems that we have here is that after these spectacular crashes and failures, we don't have a system where the press can get together, examine what happened, and change behaviors. Like, there is no 9/11 commission for the national press. And yet, the 2016 election was that kind of failure. You could argue that the lead up to the Iraq War in 2002 and 2003 was similar.
And forgive me, Jay, 9/11 was a failure of the press, too. They just didn't get that story.
9/11, economic crash in 2008, where you had these massive failures to alert the country to what's actually happening, and yet you don't see the profession called into crisis. You don't see a patient examination of the evidence of what happened. You don't see real changes in behavior. And instead, because of journalism is about today, we just go on to the next story, and there's always a next story. And this is part of the problem. This is why it's so frustrating to observe this from my position in the university.
It's an invidious pattern. And let me get another caller on here. Carrie, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to hear your guests address specifically the debates and how moderators can do a better job of fact-checking in real time, and so that the listeners are getting facts rather than just spin.
Some thoughts on that, Jay Rosen?
Wow, I think that's going to be a disaster. I really do. I think that's the kind of problem that overwhelms the system that we have for doing debates, because the president is going to throw out so many false things at such a fast rate that trying to interrupt and say, wait a minute, that's not true. If you did try to do that, you would be inundated with criticism and complaints for not letting him talk. You could try to do it on some sort of tape delay basis, but then you would be anticipating that one candidate is going to break the rules and the other is not. And so the symmetrical treatment of the candidates required by the tradition of these debates defeats any possible response to what you know is going to be a hurricane of distortion and lies coming from the president. And if you remember what happened when Candy Crowley tried to correct Mitt Romney in 2012 and the kind of hatred that came down on her and the kind of criticism that the Republican establishment sent her way, I just think it's not going to happen. And instead, the news media is going to revert to fact-checking after the debate. And it's just going to be a festival of deception from beginning to end. And I wish I had a better answer for you.
I'm going to read a comment from a listener who says that he finds the press doesn't report on stories favorable to Trump. A good example is the two Nobel Prize nominations and the Israel-United Arab Emirates-Bahrain peace treaties. That is an argument certainly you hear from those who are in favor of the president. And is it a fair argument to some degree?
Well, the Nobel nominations are fictional. So it's not quite fair to say that, but
there were a couple of nominations that came from Norwegians. His name was put in nomination by someone who was an ultra.
Well, the recent story that I saw about that was said that it was actually forged document. Now, maybe I got my facts wrong, but if there were such nominations, that's news. It's worth reporting. It should be reported. Another way to say it is, traditionally, presidents who wanted the news media to focus on their accomplishments tried to make news only about those accomplishments and not crowd the news agenda with 44 other lies and distortions that journalists would chase as stories. So if President Trump wants more clarity and focus on the good things that he's doing, he should stop making news about all the lies and misstatements he's making.
All right, if you're on the line, hang on. We'll try to get to your calls and certainly read some of these emails that are coming in. We're talking about how the media should cover President Trump and the 2020 election with Jay Rosen. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. How do you think the media has covered President Trump, and what do you think they should do differently for this election? You can give us a call now at our toll-free number and join the program. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And here's Greg, who sends an email. Jay Rosen says, can you provide specific advice for what reporters should actually say? Maybe you can give us some good examples. I was thinking about the example, I think it was in one of your writings about when President Trump was saying that Ted Cruz's father was somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination, and Jake Tapper said this is simply not true. It's shameful, and that you're saying something of this sort because it's absolutely blatantly false when Trump was campaigning against Ted Cruz.
Well, the point that Tapper made, which I thought was excellent, was after he corrected this statement that Trump had made about Cruz's father, he said, and this is an important distinction, he said, that's not a pro-Cruz position I just took. It's not an anti-Trump position. It's a pro-truth position. And he explained himself as that. And I think that's the way to address this fear of taking sides, is you are on the side of a factual public record. You are on the side of free and fair elections. I think it's legitimate for journalists to be on the side of everyone shall participate in the 2020 vote and have their vote counted. They can be on the side of a fact-based debate. And this is where I think our journalists get a little bit lost when they think they can't take a stand. They could take a stand for these basic values of a democratic society. And in fact, if they don't do that, if they don't defend these things, then they really have no purpose.
But if they're lied to over and over again, if the public is lied to over and over again, there is a sense of a kind of numbness or being inured to all those prevarications. I mean, they sort of
yes.
go on. That's a real phenomenon that we are faced with, is it not?
Sure, but sticking to your maxim, what the president says is news, is not going to help you out of that trap. And this is another problem in covering Trump, is that he makes these traditional notions completely unworkable. And then the press has to try to invent new routines and new assumptions on the fly. And it's not built to do that.
Let me bring another caller in from Washington State. Tina joins us. Tina, welcome. You're on the air.
Thanks, Michael, for taking my call. And this is just a really, really important conversation. And I think part of the problem is that the press is playing by traditional rules, and Donald Trump thumbs his nose at traditions of all sorts. And so you end up with this kind of two ships almost passing in the dark. And the other piece, the comment I have really is, you know, when he said that voters should vote once by mail and once in person just to go check on the system, and so many headlines said, Trump says vote twice. And I started sending messages and tweeting and doing whatever I could, because it's like, that's a place where we should say, Trump says to illegally vote twice. I mean, like, put it so the story is in the headline, because a lot of people just read the headline and think, oh, okay, our president's now telling us to vote twice, and off they go, and they don't stop to think about the fact that we all know that's illegal. And so there's got to be a way for the press to, as Jay is saying, defend the Constitution, defend our institutions, and not just say that anything the president says is newsworthy, because it's not. They're lies. And unless lies are newsworthy, after 21,000 of them, I think we run a risk of playing right into his propaganda hands.
Tina, I thank you for that call. Jay Rosen, response from you?
I think what's so difficult about this issue is the strategic uses of confusion. We're used to presidents who, even if they are shading the truth a little bit or spinning the facts a little bit, are trying to be clear about what their stand is. And one of the strange things about doing journalism about Donald Trump is that very often he's trying to create confusion in what he says and what he does. And this is the method of flooding the zone. This is the Russian-style disinformation politics that Trump has unwittingly or deliberately borrowed. Is you create so much confusion and so much fear that people give up trying to understand what the truth is. And that's a method of press control, or neutralizing the press, that I don't think we understand very well. Overwhelming the public sphere with too much information and trying to confuse the picture so nobody can figure out, and eventually people give up, that is an unusual way to conduct yourself as president of the United States, and it's an unusual use of the public platform of the presidency.
Well, you're also talking about earlier the anachronistic sense that some journalists have in the way they were trained as opposed to the way things work under the Trump administration, but the whole landscape of the media has changed. I mean, we've gone to power with the tech platforms, with the internet, with what you describe as faux populists turned into against liberal media with resentment politics, but also Fox News the sources that can simply find a following. I wonder about U.S. newspapers in this whole picture. I mean, they've shed half of their newsroom employees since 2008. They've been further ravaged by the pandemic. How do they play in now?
Well, at one time we had what were kind of quaintly called gatekeepers. We had a limited number of sources of information, and There were advantages of that world. There are a lot of disadvantages of that world. But now I can't even say that the gatekeepers have that kind of power anymore. We still have the media. We still have the national media. We still have something resembling local newspapers, but they are in no sense in charge of what gets into the public sphere, which stories come to people's attention, because the primary relationship now people have is with the platforms. This is why when you are cruising around the web and you land on a newspaper site or a magazine, they immediately try to get you to become subscribers to their newsletter, because they're trying to recreate a direct relationship with you, because they know that the platforms have actually grabbed hold of that relationship. That's part of the problem here, is that the tech platforms are in charge of the relationship between news system and news consumer, but they don't have the same editorial values that the old system had. And it's important to remember that Facebook works as a ad mechanism just as well with fake information as true information. And so this is definitely part of the problem, and it's another part of the news system that's just broken.
Our guest is Jay Rosen, and he teaches journalism at New York University, writes the blog PressThink.org. I want to read some emails that are coming in. A listener writes, the media constantly repeats clips of Trump's false statements, followed by a disclaimer. Please just report what he said and why it is wrong. Otherwise, the repetition of the lies merely adds the appearance of veracity and gives Trump what he most desires, exposure. Another listener writes, Trump has relentlessly vilified the press, calling them enemies of the people and sowing such pervasive distrust among those who are inclined to receive his words as gospel. And yet another listener emails us and writes, a pernicious side effect of Fox News' misinformation network is that now intelligent people question award-winning mainstream media. I had a disturbing conversation with a very bright friend who used false equivalence to suggest that the New York Times also has misinformation. We're talking again with Jay Rosen. Let me bring another caller on, and Annette is next. Annette, good morning. Welcome.
Well, sorry. Hi.
Hi, and Annette's calling us from Chicago. Go ahead, Annette. I'm sorry.
Hi. I'm so glad I'm finally on. Instead of focusing on what he says, to focus on proper procedure and public administration, I'm irritated and annoyed that I constantly have to listen to this. I call him an orc. Anyway. If anybody has read Lord of the Rings, you know who I mean. But the thing is that excessive people only want controversy and candy. It's light. I want something with teeth. And it's not what I'm getting. I have to find it somewhere else. And I have to find it also in foreign newspapers where I can get some normalcy about it. And I think also that Americans run on fear. They grow up with it, fear of X, Y, and or Z. And it just doesn't let up. And he knows very well how to use that. It's not just confusing, it's the fear.
Yeah, Ned, I thank you for those comments and those remarks. Appreciate hearing from you. And Jay Rosen, let me go back to what we started talking about. What about this campaign against mail-in ballots and sabotaging the post office and all the rest of it? What's the role for journalists here, as you see it?
I think they have to acknowledge the gravity of the situation we're in, which is that there is a threat to American democracy out there and gathering steam. It's led by the President of the United States. It's trying to undermine the election and trust in the outcome of the election, or make it impossible for America to have a free and fair vote. Not only do journalists have to report on what's happening in the gathering of that threat, but they have to somehow figure out how, within their ethics and professional sense of responsibility, they can set themselves against it. They have to fight against it from within the resources they have. And they just have to say goodbye to the much easier and much more fun way of reporting an election, because they're distorting the situation just by using some of their routines. An example would be, Michael, it's easy to say, here's what Biden's campaign message is compared to Trump's campaign message of law and order. Because at that very abstract level, it kind of sort of sounds like we have a campaign like we're used to. But that is such a distortion of what's actually happening around the ground. The American democracy and the central ritual of that democracy is under threat, and it's under threat from the government itself. That is not just a big story. That's the crisis of a lifetime for American journalists.
Well, you write about, for example, Peter Baker of the New York Times, and really kind of scold him, if I could put it that idiomatically, because they're guilty of a kind of fantasy of detachment, I think is your phrasing. That fantasy of detachment has probably hurt journalism to a great degree. And in fact, I'm looking at a listener who writes here, and this may be tied to that. Listener sends an email and says, why aren't major newspapers running more stories about the safety and reliability of mail-in voting and more on how the U.S. Post Office is working to prepare and ensure ballots arrive on time? I think that's a worthy point, especially in light of what we're talking about here and what the responsibility is of journalism.
I think it's very important. And there have been stories about the post office. It's not that the issue isn't covered. It's that we need a coherent response to the entire crisis. The threat against the post office is just one part of it. And somehow our press corps needs to kind of like wake up to the crisis that's right in front of them and come up with a different way of covering this election, because there isn't that much time left and it's getting, you know, it's getting really bad out there.
I'm going to read a comment from Gina, and I'd like your response, Jay Rosen. Gina writes, it's in the best interest of corporate media to broadcast horse race nonsense rather than discuss issues and policy, not just Fox, but look at MSNBC continually pushing electability and toxic Bernie supporters rather than discussing policy during the Democratic primary. I mean, I suppose there's some sense that we have to reckon with that. If you want to get the clicks, if you want to get the ratings and so forth, controversy works. It does. Negativity works. The horse race works. Stirring up outrage works. Those things have been tried and true, and they utilize them.
It is true that even the media properties that are resolutely against Trump and relentlessly critical of him are caught in this bind where by focusing on Trump, they also please their audiences. And that is a problem. It's a trap. And I don't exactly know what the answer to that is. But if we could step back from that for a second, what I would like to see the news media do is employ a distinction that the sociologist C. Wright Mills used to use a long time ago in the 1950s. He would distinguish between troubles on the one hand and issues on the other. And troubles are the things in people's lives that are actively bothering them, the things that they worry about, things that affect their families, that are going to affect their future. Those are troubles. Issues are what the political system makes to fight about and to run campaigns on and to win and lose on. And his point was that when troubles are disconnected from issues, or issues don't speak to troubles, you have a crisis of democracy. Somehow, our journalists have to get in touch with people's troubles and make that their priority, make that their starting point, rather than Trump's latest outrage.
It's so good to hear the name C. Wright Mills. I haven't heard it in years. One of my early heroes, in fact.
Yeah, he was great.
We've got a little time left here, Jay. Is there a role for traditional politics reporting, or is that framing obsolete?
Well, there's a role for it when the conditions it requires are still around. I mean, if you still have races somewhere around the country where there's two candidates who are both reality-based, there are issues for the community to face that aren't distorted by this culture war we've been talking about. You know, if you can find kind of oases where a common world of facts still exists and propaganda hasn't overtaken everything, then some of the methods of traditional journalism may still apply. But more and more, even the local level of politics is being invaded by these forces, one of which we didn't talk about today is QAnon, this sprawling conspiracy theory that is kind of like taking over people's minds and causing them to believe bizarre things like child molestation cults infesting the Democratic Party.
Like, we need a whole separate hour to talk about QAnon.
Yeah, like when that strikes, there's very little that you can do with traditional tools of journalism.
We have come to the end of this hour, alas, but it's really been good to have you on, Jay Rosen, and I thank you. And thank you for the work you've done. Jay Rosen, again, teaches journalism at NYU and writes the blog PressThink.org. Appreciate your being with us, Jay. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
And I'll be back with you tomorrow. We want to hear from you. Can you describe your life over the past 6 months in 6 words? You can share a 6-word pandemic memoir with us on social media or leave us a voicemail now at 415-553-3300. That number again, 415-553-3300, or email us a voice memo at forum@kqed.org. We'll share some of these on air tomorrow. And thank you so much for being a part of this morning's program. I always remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Stay tuned for another hour of the Forum program with Mina Kim. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny. Stay safe.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.